Alias Grace by Margaret Atwood. Read by Shelley Thompson. Whatever may have happened through these years, God knows I speak truth, saying that you lie. William Morris, The Defense of Guinevere. I have no tribunal. Emily Dickinson, Letters. I cannot tell you what the light is, but I can tell you what it is not. What is the motive of the light? What is the light? Eugene Marais, The Soul of the White Ant. 1. Jagged Edge. At the time of my visit, there were only 40 women in the penitentiary. This speaks much for the superior moral training of the feebler sex. My chief object in visiting their department was to look at the celebrated murderess, Grace Marks, of whom I had heard a great deal, not only from the public papers, but from the gentleman who defended her upon her trial, and whose able pleading saved her from the gallows on which her wretched accomplice closed his guilty career. Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. Come, see real flowers of this painful world. Basho, out of the gravel there are peonies growing. They come up through the loose gray pebbles, their buds testing the air like snails' eyes, then swelling and opening, huge dark red flowers all shining and glossy like satin. Then they burst and fall to the ground. In the one instant before they come apart, they're like the peonies in the front garden at Mr. Kinnear's that first day, only those were white. Nancy was cutting them. She wore a pale dress with pink rosebuds and a triple flounce skirt and a straw bonnet that hid her face. She carried a flat basket to put the flowers in. She bent from the hips like a lady holding her waist straight. When she heard us and turned to look, she put her hand up to her throat as if startled. I tuck my head down while I walk, keeping step with the rest, eyes lowered, silently two by two around the yard, inside the square made by the high stone walls. My hands are clasped in front of me. They're chapped, the knuckles reddened. I can't remember a time when they were not like that. The toes of my shoes go in and out under the hem of my skirt, blue and white, crunching on the pathway. These shoes fit me better than any I've ever had before. It's 1851. I'll be 24 years old next birthday. I've been shut up in here since the age of 16. I'm a model prisoner and give no trouble. That's what the governor's wife says. I've overheard her saying it. I'm skilled at overhearing. If I am good enough and quiet enough, perhaps after all they will let me go. But it's not easy being quiet and good. It's like hanging on to the edge of a bridge when you've already fallen over. You don't seem to be moving, just dangling there. And yet it is taking all your strength. I watch the peonies out of the corners of my eyes. I know they shouldn't be here. It's April, and peonies don't bloom in April. There are three more now right in front of me, growing out of the path itself. Furtively I reach out my hand to touch one. It has a dry feel, and I realize it's made of cloth. Then, up ahead, I see Nancy on her knees, with her hair fallen over and the blood running down into her eyes. Around her neck is a white cotton kerchief printed with blue flowers, love in a mist. It's mine. She's lifting up her face. She's holding out her hands to me for mercy. In her ears are the little gold earrings I used to envy, but I no longer begrudge them. Nancy can keep them. Because this time it will all be different. This time I will run to help. I will lift her up and wipe away the blood with my skirt. I will tear a bandage from my petticoat, and none of it will have happened. Mr. Kinnear will come home in the afternoon. He will ride up the driveway, and McDermott will take the horse, and Mr. Kinnear will go into the parlor, and I will make him some coffee. And Nancy will take it to him on a tray the way she likes to, and he will say, "What good coffee!" And at night the fireflies will come out in the orchard, and there will be music by lamplight. Jamie Walsh. the boy with the flute. I am almost up to Nancy, to where she's kneeling, but I do not break step, I do not run. I keep on walking two by two, and then Nancy smiles, only the mouth, her eyes are hidden by the blood and hair, and then she scatters into patches of color, a drift of red cloth petals across the stones. I put my hands over my eyes because it's dark suddenly, and a man is standing there with a candle, blocking the stairs that go up, and the cellar walls are all around me, and I know I will never get out. This is what I told Dr. Jordan when we came to that part of the story. 2. Rocky Road. On Tuesday, about 10 minutes past 12 o'clock, at the new jail in this city, James McDermott, the murderer of Mr. Kinnear, underwent the extreme sentence of the law. There was an immense concourse of men, women, and children anxiously waiting to witness the last struggle of a sinful fellow being. What kinds of feelings those women can possess who flocked from far and near through mud and rain to be present at the horrid spectacle, we cannot divine. We venture to say they were not very delicate or refined. The wretched criminal displayed the same coolness and intrepidity at this awful moment that has marked his conduct ever since his arrest. Toronto Mirror, November 23, 1843. Offense: laughing and talking. Punishment: 6 lashes, cat-o'-nine-tails. Offense: talking in washhouse. Punishment: 6 lashes, rawhide. Offense: threatening to knock convict's brains out. Punishment: 24 lashes, cat-o'-nine-tails. Offense: talking to keepers on matters not related to their work. Punishment: 6 lashes, cat-o'-nine-tails. Offense: finding fault with rations when required by guards to sit down. Punishment: 6 lashes, rawhide, and bread and water. Offense: staring about and inattentive at breakfast table. Punishment: bread and water. Offense: leaving work and going to privy when other convict there. Punishment: 36 hours in dark cell, and bread and water. Punishment Book, Kingston Penitentiary, 1843. The murders of Thomas Kinnear, Esquire, and of his housekeeper, Nancy Montgomery, at Richmond Hill, and the trials of Grace Marks and James McDermott, and the hanging of James McDermott at the new jail in Toronto, November 21st, 1843. Grace Marks, she was a serving maid. Her age was 16 years. McDermott was the stable hand. They worked at Thomas Kinnear's. Now Thomas Kinnear was a gentleman, and a life of ease led he, and he did love his housekeeper, called Nancy Montgomery. Oh, Nancy dear, do not despair. To town I now must go, to bring some money home for you, from the bank in Toronto. Oh, Nancy's no well-born lady. Oh, Nancy, she is no queen. And yet she goes in satin and silk, the finest was ever seen. Oh, Nancy's no well-born lady, yet she treats me like a slave. She works me so hard from dawn to dark, she'll work me into my grave. Now Grace, she loved good Thomas Kinnear. McDermott, he loved Grace, and 'twas these loves, as I do tell, that brought them to disgrace. Oh, Grace, please be my own true love. Oh, no, it cannot be. Unless you kill for my dear sake Nancy Montgomery. He struck a blow all with his axe on the head of Nancy Fair. He dragged her to the cellar door and threw her down the stairs. Oh, spare my life, McDermott. Oh, spare my life, said she. Oh, spare my life, Grace Marks, she said, and I'll give you my dresses 3. Oh, 'tis not for my own sake, nor yet my babe unborn, but for my true love, Thomas Kinnear, I'd live to see the morn. McDermott held her by the hair, and Grace Marks by the head, and these two monstrous criminals, they strangled her till dead. What have I done? My soul is lost, and for my life I fear. Then to save ourselves when he returns, we must murder Thomas Kinnear. Oh, no, I beg not so. I plead for his life full sore. No, he must die, for you have sworn you'd be my paramour. Now Thomas Kinnear came riding home, and on the kitchen floor McDermott shot him through the heart, and he weltered in his gore. The peddler came up to the house. Will you buy a dress of me? Oh, go away, Mr. Peddler, I've dresses enough for three. The butcher came up to the house. He came there every week. Oh, go away, Mr. Butcher, we've got enough fresh meat. They robbed Kinnear of his silver. They robbed him of his gold. They stole his horse and wagon, and to Toronto they rode. All in the middle of the night to Toronto they did flee, then across the lake to the United States, thinking they would scape free. She took McDermott by the hand, as bold could be, and stopped at the Lewiston Hotel under the name of Mary Whitney. The corpses were found in the cellar. Her face, it was all black, and she was under the washtub, and he was laid out on his back. Then Bailiff Kingsmill in pursuit, a charter he did take, which sailed as fast as it could go to Lewiston across the lake. They had not been in bed 6 hours, 6 hours or maybe more, when to the Lewiston Hotel he came and knocked upon the door. "Oh, who is there?" said Grace so fair. "What business have you with me?" "Oh, you have murdered good Thomas Kinnear and Nancy Montgomery." Grace Marks, she stood up in the dock, and she denied it all. "I did not see her strangled. I did not hear him fall. He forced me to accompany him. He said if I did tell, then with one shot of his trusty gun, he'd send me straight to hell." McDermott stood up in the dock. "I did not do it alone, but for the sake of her person fair, Grace Marks, she led me on." Young Jamie Walsh stood up in court, the truth he swore to tell. "Oh, Grace is wearing Nancy's dress, and Nancy's bonnet as well." McDermott by the neck they hanged, upon the gallows high, and Grace in prison drear they cast where she must pine and sigh. They hanged him for an hour or two, then took down the body and cut it into pieces at the university. From Nancy's grave there grew a rose, and from Thomas Kinnear's a vine. They grew so high they intertwined, and thus these two were joined. But all her weary life Grace Marks must in prison locked up be, because of her foul sin and crime in the Kingston Penitentiary. But if Grace Marks repent at last and for her sins atone, then when she comes to die, she'll stand at her Redeemer's throne. At her Redeemer's throne she'll stand, and she'll be cured of woe. And he her bloodied hands will wash, and she'll be white as snow. And she will be as white as snow, and into heaven will pass. And she will dwell in paradise. In paradise, at last. 3. Puss in the Corner. She is a middle-sized woman with a slight, graceful figure. There is an air of hopeless melancholy in her face which is very painful to contemplate. Her complexion is fair, and must, before the touch of hopeless sorrow paled it, have been very brilliant. Her eyes are a bright blue, her hair auburn, and her face would be rather handsome were it not for the long, curved chin which gives, as it always does to most persons who have this facial defect, a cunning, cruel expression. Grace Marks glances at you with a sidelong, stealthy look. Her eye never meets yours, and after a furtive regard it invariably bends its gaze upon the ground. She looks like a person rather above her humble station. Susanna Moody, Life in the Clearings, 1853. The captive raised her face. It was as soft and mild as sculptured marble saint or slumbering unweaned child. It was so soft and mild, it was so sweet and fair, pain could not trace a line or grief a shadow there. The captive raised her hand and pressed it to her brow. "I have been struck," she said, "and I am suffering now. Yet these are little worth, your bolts and iron strong, and were they forged in steel, they could not hold me long." Emily Bronte, The Prisoner, 1845. 1859. I am sitting on the purple velvet settee in the governor's parlor, the governor's wife's parlor. It has always been the governor's wife's parlor, although it is not always the same wife, as they change them around according to politics. I have my hands folded in my lap the proper way, although I have no gloves. The gloves I would wish to have would be smooth and white and would fit without a wrinkle. I am often in this parlor, clearing away the tea things and dusting the small tables and the long mirror with a frame of grapes and leaves round it and the pianoforte, and the tall clock that came from Europe with the orange-gold sun and the silver moon that go in and out according to the time of day and the week of the month. I like the clock best of anything in the parlor, although it measures time, and I have too much of that on my hands already. But I've never sat down on the settee before, as it is for the guests. Mrs. Alderman Parkinson said a lady must never sit in a chair a gentleman has just vacated, though she would not say why. But Mary Whitney said, "Because, you silly goose, it's still warm from his bum," which was a coarse thing to say. So I cannot sit here without thinking of the ladylike bums that have sat on this very settee, all delicate and white, like wobbly, soft-boiled eggs. The visitors wear afternoon dresses with rows of buttons up their fronts and stiff wire crinolines beneath. It's a wonder they can sit down at all, and when they walk, nothing touches their legs under the billowing skirts, except their shifts and stockings. They are like swans, drifting along on unseen feet, or else like the jellyfish in the waters of the rocky harbor near our house when I was little, before I ever made the long, sad journey across the ocean. They were bell-shaped and ruffled, gracefully waving and lovely under the sea, but if they washed up on the beach and dried out in the sun, there was nothing left of them. And that is what the ladies are like, mostly water. There were no wire crinolines when I was first brought here. They were horsehair then, as the wire ones were not thought of. I've looked at them hanging in the wardrobes when I go in to tidy and empty the slops. They are like bird cages. But what is being caged in? Legs. The legs of ladies. Legs penned in so they cannot get out and go rubbing up against the gentleman's trousers. The governor's wife never says legs, although the newspaper said legs when they were talking about Nancy, with her dead legs sticking out from under the wash tub. It isn't only the jellyfish ladies that come. On Tuesdays we have the woman question, and the emancipation of this or that with reform-minded persons of both sexes, and on Thursdays the spiritualist circle for tea and conversing with the dead, which is a comfort to the governor's wife because of her departed infant son. But mainly it is the ladies. They sit sipping from the thin cups, and the governor's wife rings a little china bell. She does not like being the governor's wife. She would prefer the governor to be the governor of something other than a prison. The governor had good enough friends to get him made the governor, but not for anything else. So here she is, and she must make the most of her social position and accomplishments, and although an object of fear like a spider, and of charity as well. I am also one of the accomplishments. I come into the room and curtsy and move about, mouth straight, head bent, and I pick up the cups or set them down, depending, and they stare, without appearing to, out from under their bonnets. The reason they want to see me is that I am a celebrated murderess, or that is what has been written down. When I first saw it, I was surprised, because they say celebrated singer, and celebrated poetess, and celebrated spiritualist, and celebrated actress. But what is there to celebrate about murder? All the same, murderess is a strong word to have attached to you. It has a smell to it, that word, musky and oppressive like dead flowers in a vase. Sometimes at night I whisper it over to myself, murderess, murderess. It rustles like a taffeta skirt across the floor. Murderer is merely brutal. It's like a hammer or a lump of metal. I would rather be a murderess than a murderer, if those are the only choices. Sometimes when I'm dusting the mirror with the grapes, I look at myself in it, although I know it is vanity. In the afternoon light of the parlor, my skin is a pale mauve like a faded bruise, and my teeth are greenish. I think of all the things that have been written about me, that I am an inhuman female demon, that I am an innocent victim of a blackguard forced against my will and in danger of my own life, that I was too ignorant to know how to act, and that to hang me would be judicial murder, that I am fond of animals, that I am very handsome with a brilliant complexion, that I have blue eyes, that I have green eyes, that I have auburn and also brown hair, that I am tall and also not above the average height, that I am well and decently dressed, that I robbed a dead woman to appear so, that I am brisk and smart about my work, that I am of sullen disposition with a quarrelsome temper, that I have the appearance of a person rather above my humble station, that I am a good girl with a pliable nature and no harm is told of me, that I am cunning and devious, that I am soft in the head and little better than an idiot. And I wonder, how can I be all these different things at once? It was my own lawyer, Mr. Kenneth Mackenzie, Esquire, who told them I was next door to an idiot. I was angry with him over that, but he said it was by far my best chance and I should not appear to be too intelligent. He said he would plead my case to the utmost of his ability because, whatever the truth of the matter, I was little more than a child at the time, and he supposed it came down to free will and whether or not one held with it. He was a kind gentleman, although I could not make head nor tail of much of what he said, but it must have been good pleading. The newspapers wrote that he performed heroically against overwhelming odds, although I don't know why they called it pleading, as he was not pleading, but trying to make all of the witnesses appear immoral or malicious, or else mistaken. I wonder if he ever believed a word I said. When I have gone out of the room with the tray, the ladies look at the governor's wife's scrapbook. "Oh, imagine, I feel quite faint," they say, "and you let that woman walk around loose in your house. You must have nerves of iron. My own would never stand it." "Oh, well, one must get used to such things in our situation. We are virtually prisoners ourselves, you know, although one must feel pity for these poor benighted creatures, and after all, she was trained as a servant, and it's as well to keep them employed. She is a wonderful seamstress, quite deft and accomplished. She is a great help in that way, especially with the girls' frocks. She has an eye for trimmings, and under happier circumstances, she could have made an excellent milliner's assistant. Although naturally she can only be here during the day, I would not have her in the house at night. You are aware that she has spent time in the lunatic asylum in Toronto? 7 or 8 years ago it was, and although she appears to be perfectly recovered, you never know when they may get carried away again. Sometimes she talks to herself and sings out loud in a most peculiar manner. One cannot take chances. The keepers conduct her back in the evenings and lock her up properly. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to sleep a wink. Oh, I don't blame you. There's only so far one can go in Christian charity. A leopard cannot change its spots, and no one could say that you have not done your duty and shown a proper feeling. The governor's wife's scrapbook is kept on the round table with the silk shawl covering it, branches like vines intertwined, with flowers and red fruit and blue birds. It is really one large tree, and if you stare at it long enough, the vines begin to twist as if a wind is blowing them. It was sent from India by her eldest daughter, who is married to a missionary. which is not a thing I would care to do myself. You would be sure to die early, if not from the rioting natives, as at Cawnpore, with horrid outrages committed on the persons of respectable gentlewomen, and a mercy they were all slaughtered and put out of their misery, for only think of the shame. Then from the malaria, which turns you entirely yellow, and you expire in raving fits. In any case, before you could turn around, there you would be buried under a palm tree in a foreign clime. I've seen pictures of them in the book of Eastern engravings the governor's wife takes out when she wishes to shed a tear. On the same round table is the stack of Godey's ladies' books, with the fashions that come up from the States, and also the keepsake albums of the two younger daughters. Miss Lydia tells me I am a romantic figure, but then the two of them are so young they hardly know what they're saying. Sometimes they pry and tease. They say, "Grace, why don't you ever smile or laugh? We never see you smiling." And I say, "I suppose, miss, I've gotten out of the way of it. My face won't bend in that direction anymore. But if I laughed out loud, I might not be able to stop. And also it would spoil their romantic notion of me. Romantic people are not supposed to laugh. I know that much from looking at the pictures." The daughters put all kinds of things into their albums, little scraps of cloth from their dresses, little snippets of ribbon, pictures cut from magazines, the ruins of ancient Rome, the picturesque monasteries of the French Alps, old London Bridge, Niagara Falls in summer and in winter, which is the thing I would like to see, as all say it is very impressive, and portraits of Lady This and Lord That from England. And their friends write things in their graceful handwriting. "To dearest Lydia from your eternal friend Clara Richards. To dearest Marianne, in memory of our splendid picnic on the shores of bluest Lake Ontario," and also poems. "As round about the sturdy oak entwines the loving ivy vine, my faith so true I pledge to you, 'twill evermore be none but thine, your faithful Laura." Or else, "Although from you I far must roam, do not be broken-hearted. We two, who in the soul are one, are never truly parted. Your Lucy." This young lady was shortly afterwards drowned in the lake when her ship went down in a gale, and nothing was ever found but her box with her initials done in silver nails. It was still locked, so although damp, nothing spilt out, and Miss Lydia was given a scarf out of it as a keepsake. "When I am dead and in my grave, and all my bones are rotten, when this you see, remember me, lest I should be forgotten." That one is signed, "I will always be with you in spirit, your loving Nancy, Hannah Edmonds." And I must say, the first time I saw that, it gave me a fright, although, of course, it was a different Nancy. Still, the rotten bones. They would be by now. Her face was all black by the time they found her. There must have been a dreadful smell. It was so hot then. It was July. Still, she went off surprisingly soon. You'd think she would have kept longer in the dairy. It is usually cool down there. I'm certainly glad I was not present, as it would have been very distressing. I don't know why they are all so eager to be remembered. What good will it do them? There are some things that should be forgotten by everyone and never spoken of again. The governor's wife's scrapbook is quite different. Of course, she is a grown woman and not a young girl, so although she is just as fond of remembering, what she wants to remember is not violets or a picnic. No dearest and love and beauty, no eternal friends. None of those things for her. What it has instead is all the famous criminals in it. The ones that have been hanged or else brought here to be penitent, because this is a penitentiary, and you are supposed to repent while in it, and you will do better if you say you have done so, whether you have anything to repent of or not. The governor's wife cuts these crimes out of the newspapers and pastes them in. She would even write away for old newspapers with crimes that were done before her time. It is her collection. She is a lady, and they are all collecting things these days. And so she must collect something, and she does this instead of pulling up ferns or pressing flowers, and in any case she likes to horrify her acquaintances. so I have read what they put in about me. She showed the scrapbook to me herself. I suppose she wanted to see what I would do. But I've learned how to keep my face still. I made my eyes wide and flat like an owl's in torchlight, and I said I had repented in bitter tears and was now a changed person, and would she wish me to remove the tea things now? But I've looked in there since many times when I've been in the parlor by myself. A lot of it is lies. They said in the newspaper that I was illiterate, but I could read some even then. I was taught early by my mother before she got too tired for it. And I did my sampler with leftover thread. A is for apple, B is for bee. And also, Mary Whitney used to read with me at Mrs. Alderman Parkinson's when we were doing the mending. And I've learned a lot more since being here, as they teach you on purpose. They want you to be able to read the Bible, and also tracts, as religion and thrashing are the only remedies for a depraved nature, and our immortal souls must be considered. It is shocking how many crimes the Bible contains. The governor's wife should cut them all out and paste them into her scrapbook. They did say some true things. They said I had a good character. And that was so, because nobody had ever taken advantage of me, although they tried. But they called James McDermott my paramour. They wrote it down right in the newspaper. I think it's disgusting to write such things down. That is what really interests them, the gentlemen and the ladies, both. They don't care if I killed anyone. I could have cut dozens of throats. It's only what they admire in a soldier. They'd scarcely blink. No. Was I really a paramour, is their chief concern. And they don't even know themselves whether they want the answer to be no or yes. I'm not looking at the scrapbook now because they may come in at any moment. I sit with my rough hands folded, eyes down, staring at the flowers in the Turkey carpet. Or they're supposed to be flowers. They have petals the shape of the diamonds on a playing card, like the cards spread out on the table at Mr. Kinnear's after the gentleman had been playing the night before. Hard and angular, but red. A deep, thick red. Thick, strangled tongues. It's not the ladies expected today, it's a doctor. He's writing a book. The governor's wife likes to know people who are writing books. Books with forward-looking aims. It shows that she is a liberal-minded person with advanced views, and science is making such progress. And what with modern inventions and the Crystal Palace, and world knowledge assembled, who knows where we will all be in 100 years? When there's a doctor, it's always a bad sign. Even when they are not doing the killing themselves, it means a death is close. And in that way, they are all like ravens or crows. But this doctor will not hurt me, the governor's wife promised it. All he wants to do is measure my head. He is measuring the heads of all the criminals in the penitentiary to see if he can tell from the bumps on their skulls what sort of criminals they are, whether they are pickpockets or swindlers or embezzlers or criminal lunatics or murderers. She did not say, like you, Grace. And then they could lock those people up before they had a chance to commit any crimes. And think how that would improve the world. After James McDermott was hanged, they made a plaster cast of his head. I read that in the scrapbook, too. I suppose that's what they wanted it for, to improve the world. Also, his body was dissected. When I first read that, I did not know what dissected was. But I found out soon enough. It was done by the doctors. They cut him into pieces like a pig to be salted down. He might as well have been bacon as far as they were concerned. His body that I listened to breathing and the heart beating. The knife slicing through it. I can't bear to think of it. I wonder what they did with his shirt. Was it one of the four sold to him by Jeremiah the peddler? It should have been three. Or else five, as odd numbers are luckier. Jeremiah always wished me luck, but he did not wish any to James McDermott. I did not see the hanging. They hanged him in front of the jail in Toronto, and you should have been there, Grace, say the keepers. It would have been a lesson to you. I've pictured it many times. Poor James standing with his hands tied and his neck bare while they put the hood over his head like a kitten to be drowned. At least he had a priest with him. He was not all alone. If it had not been for Grace Marks, he told them, none of it would have happened. It was raining, and a huge crowd standing in the mud, some of them come from miles away. If my own death sentence had not been commuted at the last minute, they would have watched me hang with the same greedy pleasure. There were many women and ladies there. Everyone wanted to stare. They wanted to breathe death in like fine perfume. And when I read of it, I thought, if this is a lesson to me, what is it I'm supposed to be learning? I can hear their footsteps now, and I stand up quickly and brush my apron smooth. Then there's the voice of a strange man. This is most kind of you, ma'am, and the governor's wife saying, I'm so happy to be of help, and he says again, most kind. Then he comes through the doorway, big stomach, black coat, tight waistcoat, silver buttons, precisely tied stock. I'm only looking up as far as the chin, and he says, this will not take long, but I'd appreciate it, ma'am, if you'd remain in the room. One must not only be virtuous, one must give the appearance of virtue. He laughs as if it is a joke, and I can hear in his voice that he is afraid of me. A woman like me is always a temptation, if possible to arrange it unobserved, as whatever we may say about it later, we will not be believed. And then I see his hand, a hand like a glove stuffed with raw meat, his hand plunging into the open mouth of his leather bag. It comes out glinting, and I know I have seen a hand like that before, and then I lift my head and stare him straight in the eye, and my heart clenches and kicks out inside me, and then I begin to scream, because it's the same doctor, the same one, the very same black-coated doctor with his bag full of shining knives. I was brought round with a glass of cold water dashed in the face, but continued screaming, although the doctor was no longer in sight, so was restrained by two kitchen maids and the gardener's boy who sat on my legs. The governor's wife had sent for the matron from the penitentiary who arrived with two of the keepers, and she gave me a brisk slap across the face, at which I stopped. It was not the same doctor in any case, it only looked like him. The same cold and greedy look, and the hate. It's the only way with the hysterics, you may be sure, ma'am, said the matron. We have had a great deal of experience with that kind of fit. This one used to be prone to them, but we never indulged her. We worked to correct it, and we thought she'd given it up. It might be her old trouble coming back, for despite what they said about it up there at Toronto, she was a raving lunatic that time 7 years ago, and you are lucky there was no scissors nor sharp things lying about. Then the keepers half dragged me back to the main prison building and locked me into this room until I was myself again, is what they said, even though I told them I was better now, that the doctor was no longer there with his knives. I said I had a fear of doctors, that was all, of being cut open by them, as some might have a fear of snakes. But they said, that's enough of your tricks, Grace. You just wanted the attention. He was not going to cut you open. He had no knives at all. It was only calipers you saw, to measure the heads with. You've given the governor's wife a real fright now, but it serves her right. She's been spoiling you too much for your own good. She's made quite a pet out of you, hasn't she? Our company is hardly good enough for you any more. Well, so much the worse. You will have to endure it now because you will have a different sort of attention for a time, until they have decided what is to be done with you. This room has only a little window high up with bars on the inside and a straw-filled mattress. I was put in a room like this before they sent me away to the asylum. I told them I wasn't mad, that I wasn't the one, but they wouldn't listen. They wouldn't know mad when they saw it in any case, because a good portion of the women in the asylum were no madder than the Queen of England. Many were sane enough when sober, as their madness came out of a bottle, which is a kind I knew very well. One of them was in there to get away from her husband, who beat her black and blue. He was the mad one, but nobody would lock him up. And another said she went mad in the autumns, as she had no house, and it was warm in the asylum. And if she didn't do a fair job of running mad, she would freeze to death. But then in the spring she would become sane again because it was good weather and she could go off and tramp in the woods and fish, and as she was part Red Indian, she was handy at such things. I would like to do that myself if I knew how, and if not afraid of the bears. But some were not pretending. One poor Irish woman had all her family dead, half of them starving in the Great Famine and the other half of the cholera on the boat coming over, and she would wander about calling their names. I'm glad I left Ireland before that time, as the sufferings she told of were dreadful and the corpses piled everywhere with none to bury them. Another woman had killed her child, and it followed her around everywhere, tugging at her skirt. Sometimes she would pick it up and hug it and kiss it, and at other times she would shriek at it and hit it away with her hands. I was afraid of that one. Another was very religious, always praying and singing. And when she found out what they said I had done, she would plague me whenever she could. "Down on your knees," she would say, "thou shalt not kill. But there is always God's grace for sinners. Repent, repent while there is yet time, or damnation awaits." She was just like a preacher in church. And once she tried to baptize me with soup. Thin soup it was, and with cabbage in it. And she poured a spoonful of it over my head. When I complained of it, the matron gave me a dry look with her mouth all tight and straight across like a box lid, and she said, "Well, Grace, perhaps you should listen to her. I've never heard of you doing any true repenting, much though your hard heart stands in need of it." And then I was suddenly very angry, and I screamed, "I did nothing, I did nothing. It was her. It was her fault." "Who do you mean, Grace?" she said. "Compose yourself, or it's the cold bass and the straight waistcoat for you." And she gave the other matron a glance. "There, what did I tell you, mad as a snake?" The matrons at the asylum were all fat and strong, with big thick arms and chins that went straight down into their necks, and prim white collars, and their hair twisted up like faded rope. Sometimes they would provoke us, especially right before the visitors were to come. They wanted to show how dangerous we were, but also how well they could control us, as it made them appear more valuable and more skilled. So I stopped telling them anything. Not Dr. Bannerling, who would come into the room when I was tied up in the dark with mufflers on my hands. "Keep still, I'm here to examine you. It's no use lying to me, nor the other doctors who would visit there." Oh, indeed, what a fascinating case, as if I was a two-headed calf. At last I stopped talking altogether, except very civilly when spoken to. "Yes, ma'am. No, ma'am. Yes, and no, sir." And then I was sent back to the penitentiary, after they had all met together in their black coats. "Ahem, aha, in my opinion, and my respected colleague, sir, I beg to differ." Of course, they could not admit for an instant they had been mistaken when they first put me in. People dressed in a certain kind of clothing are never wrong. Also, they never fart. What Mary Whitney used to say was, "If there's farting in a room where they are, you may be sure you done it yourself. And even if you never did, you better not say so, or it's all, damn your insolence, and a boot in the backside and out on the street with you." She often had a crude way of speaking. She said, "you done," and not, "you did." No one had ever taught her otherwise. I used to speak that way as well, but I've learned better manners in prison. I sit down on the straw mattress. Makes a sound like shushing, like water on the shore. I shift from side to side to listen to it. I could close my eyes and think I'm by the sea, on a dry day without much wind. Outside the window far away there's someone chopping wood, the axe coming down, the unseen flash and then the dull sound. But how do I know it's even wood? It's chilly in this room. I have no shawl. I hug my arms around myself because who else is there to do it? When I was younger, I used to think that if I could hug myself tight enough, I could make myself smaller, because there was never enough room for me, at home or anywhere. But if I was smaller, then I would fit in. My hair is coming out from under my cap. Red hair of an ogre. A wild beast, the newspaper said. A monster. When they come with my dinner, I will put the slop bucket over my head and hide behind the door. And that will give them a fright. If they want a monster so badly, they ought to be provided with one. I never do such things, however. I only consider them. If I did them, they would be sure I had gone mad again. Gone mad, is what they say, and sometimes run mad. As if mad is a direction, like west. As if mad is a different house you could step into, or a separate country entirely. But when you go mad, you don't go any other place. You stay where you are. And somebody else comes in. I don't want to be left by myself in this room. The walls are too empty. There are no pictures on them, nor curtains on the little high-up window. Nothing to look at. And so you look at the wall, and after you do that for a time, there are pictures on it after all, and red flowers growing. I think I sleep. It's morning now, but which one? The second or third? There's fresh light outside the window, that's what woke me. I struggle upright, pinch myself, and blink my eyes, and get up stiff-limbed from the rustling mattress. Then I sing a song just to hear her voice and keep myself company. Holy, 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 Lord God Almighty, early in the morning our song shall rise to thee. Holy, 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 merciful and mighty, God in three persons, blessed Trinity. They can hardly object if it's a hymn to the morning. I've always been fond of sunrise. Then I drink the last of the water, then I walk around the room. Then I lift my petticoats and piss in the bucket. A few more hours and it will reek in here like a cesspool. Sleeping in your clothes makes you tired. The clothes are crumpled and also your body underneath them. I feel as if I've been rolled into a bundle and thrown on the floor. I wish I had a clean apron. Nobody comes. I'm being left to reflect on my sins and misdemeanors, and one does that best in solitude, or such is our expert and considered opinion, Grace, after long experience with these matters, in solitary confinement and sometimes in the dark. There are prisons where they keep you in there for years, without a glimpse of a tree or horse or human face. Some say it refines the complexion. I've been shut up alone before. Incorrigible, said Dr. Bannerling, a devious dissembler. Remain quiet, I'm here to examine your cerebral configuration, and first I shall measure your heartbeat and respiration. But I knew what he was up to. Take your hand off my tit, you filthy bastard, Mary Whitney would have said. But all I could say was, oh no, oh no. And no way to twist and turn, not how they'd fixed me, trussed up to the chair with the sleeves crossed over in front and tied behind, so nothing to do but sink my teeth into his fingers. And then over we went, backwards onto the floor, yowling together like two cats in a sack. He tasted of raw sausages and damp woolen underclothes. He'd have been much better for a good scalding and then put in the sun to bleach. No supper last night, or the night before that. Nothing except the bread. Not even a bit of cabbage. Well, that is to be expected. Starvation is calming to the nerves. Today it will be more bread and water, as meat is exciting to criminals and maniacs. They get the smell of it in their nostrils, just like wolves, and then you have only yourself to blame. But yesterday's water is all gone, and I'm very thirsty. I am dying of thirst. Have they forgotten I'm in here? You'll have to bring more food, or at least more water, or else I will starve, I will shrivel. My skin will dry out all yellow like old linen. I will turn into a skeleton. I will be found months, years, centuries from now, and they will say, who is this? She must have slipped our mind. Well, sweep all those bones and rubbish into the corner, but save the buttons. No sense in having them go to waste. There's no help for it now. Once you start feeling sorry for yourself, they've got you where they want you. Then they send for the chaplain. Oh, come to my arms, poor wandering soul. There is more joy in heaven over the one lost lamb. Ease your troubled mind. Kneel at my feet. Wring your hands in anguish. Describe how conscience tortures you day and night, and how the eyes of your victims follow you around the room, burning like red-hot coals. Shed tears of remorse. Confess, confess. Let me forgive and pity. Let me get up a petition for you. Tell me all. And then what did he do? Oh, shocking. And then what? The left hand or the right? How far up, exactly? Show me where. Possibly I hear a whispering. Now there's an eye looking in at me through the slit cut in the door. I can't see it, but I know it's there. Then a knocking. And I think, who could that be? The matron? The warden? Come to give me a scolding, but it can't be any of them, because nobody here does you the courtesy of knocking. They look at you through the little slit, and then they just walk in. Always knock first, said Mary Whitney. Then wait until they give you leave. You never know what they may be up to, and half of it's nothing they want you to see. They could have their fingers up their nose, or some other place. As even a gentlewoman feels the need to scratch where it itches, and if you see a pair of heels sticking out from under the bed, it's best to take no notice. They may be silk purses in the daytime, but they're all sow's ears at night. Mary was a person of democratic views. The knock again. As if I have a choice. I push my hair back under my cap and get up off the straw mattress and smooth down my dress and apron, and then I move as far back into the corner of the room as I can, and then I say quite firmly, because it's as well to keep hold of your dignity, if at all possible, "Please come in." The door opens and a man enters. He's a young man. My own age, or a little older, which is young for a man, although not for a woman, as at my age a woman is an old maid, but a man is not an old bachelor until he's 50, and even then there's still hope for the ladies, as Mary Whitney used to say. He's tall, with long legs and arms, but not what the governor's daughters would call handsome. They incline to the languid ones in the magazines, very elegant, and butter wouldn't melt in their mouths, with narrow feet in pointed boots. This man has a briskness about him which is not fashionable, and also rather large feet, although he is a gentleman, or next door to it. I don't think he is English, and so it is hard to tell. His hair is brown and wavy by nature, unruly it might be called, as if he can't make it lie flat by brushing. His coat is good, a good cut, but not new. There are shiny patches on the elbows. He has a tartan vest. Tartan has been popular ever since the Queen took up with Scotland and built a castle there, full of deer's heads, or so they say. But now I see it isn't real tartan, only checked, yellow and brown. He has a gold watch chain, so although rumpled and untended, he is not poor. He doesn't have the side whiskers, as they have begun to wear them now. I don't much like them myself. Give me a mustache or a beard, or else nothing at all. James McDermott and Mr. Kinnear were both clean-shaven, and Jamie Walsh, too, not that he had anything much to shave. Except that Mr. Kinnear had a mustache. When I used to empty his shaving basin in the mornings, I would take some of the wet soap. He used a good soap from London. And I would rub it on my skin, on the skin of my wrists, and then I would have the smell of it with me all day, at least until it was time to scrub the floors. The young man closes the door behind him. He doesn't lock it, but someone else locks it from the outside. We are locked into this room together. "Good morning, Grace," he says. "I understand that you are afraid of doctors. I must tell you right away that I myself am a doctor. My name is Dr. Jordan, Dr. Simon Jordan." I look at him quickly, then look down. I say, "Is the other doctor coming back?" "The one that frightened you," he says. "No, he is not." I say, "Then I suppose you are here to measure my head." "I would not dream of it," he says, smiling. But still he glances at my head with a measuring look. However, I have my cap on, so there's nothing he can see. Now that he's spoken, I think he must be an American. He has white teeth and is not missing any of them, at least at the front. And his face is quite long and bony. I like his smile, although it is higher on one side than the other, which gives him the air of joking. I look at his hands. They are empty. There's nothing at all in them. No rings on his fingers. "Do you have a bag with knives in it?" I say. "A leather satchel?" "No," he says, "I'm not the usual kind of doctor. I do no cutting open. Are you afraid of me, Grace?" I can't say that I am afraid of him yet. It's too early to tell what he wants. No one comes to see me here unless they want something. I would like him to say what kind of doctor he is, if he's not the usual kind, but instead he says, "I am from Massachusetts, or that is where I was born. I have traveled a good deal since then. I have been going to and fro in the earth and walking up and down in it." And he looks at me to see if I understand. "I know it is the Book of Job, before Job gets the boils and running sores and the whirlwinds. It's what Satan says to God. He must mean that he has come to test me, although he's too late for that, as God has done a great deal of testing of me already, and you would think he would be tired of it by now, but I don't say this." I look at him stupidly. I have a good stupid look, which I have practiced. I say, Have you been to France? That is where all the fashions come from. I see I have disappointed him. Yes, he says, and to England, and also to Italy and to Germany and Switzerland as well. It's very odd to be standing in a locked room in the penitentiary speaking with a strange man about France and Italy and Germany. A traveling man. He must be a wanderer, like Jeremiah the peddler. But Jeremiah traveled to earn his bread, and these other sorts of men are rich enough already. They go on voyages because they are curious. They amble around the world and stare at things. They sail across the ocean as if there's nothing to it at all, and if it goes ill with them in one place, they simply pick up and move along to another. But now it's my turn to say something. I say, I don't know how you manage, sir, amongst all the foreigners. You never know what they're saying. When the poor things first come here, they gabble away like geese, although the children can soon speak well enough. That is true, as children of any kind are very quick to learn. He smiles, and then he does a strange thing. He puts his left hand into his pocket and pulls out an apple. He walks over to me slowly, holding the apple out in front of him, like someone holding out a bone to a dangerous dog in order to win it over. This is for you, he says. I am so thirsty, the apple looks to me like a big round drop of water, cool and red. I could drink it down in one gulp. I hesitate, but then I think, there's nothing bad in an apple, and so I take it. I haven't had an apple of my own for a long time. This apple must be from last autumn, kept in a barrel in the cellar, but it seems fresh enough. I am not a dog, I say to him. Most people would ask me what I mean by saying that, but he laughs. His laugh is just one breath, ha, as if he's found a thing he has lost, and he says, no, Grace, I can see you are not a dog. What is he thinking? I stand holding the apple in both hands. It feels precious, like a heavy treasure. I lift it up and smell it. It has such an odor of outdoors on it. I want to cry. Aren't you going to eat it? He says. No, not yet, I say. Why not? He says. Because then it will be gone, I say. The truth is, I don't want him watching me while I eat. I don't want him to see my hunger. If you have a need and they find it out, they will use it against you. The best way is to stop from wanting anything. He gives his one laugh. Can you tell me what it is? He says. I look at him, then look away. An apple, I say. He must think I'm simple, or else it's a trick of some sort, or else he's mad, and that is why they locked the door. They've locked me into this room with a madman. But men who are dressed in clothes like his cannot be mad, especially the gold watch chain. His relatives, or else his keepers, would have it off him in a trice, if so. He smiles his lopsided smile. What does apple make you think of? He says. I beg your pardon, sir, I say. I do not understand you. It must be a riddle. I think of Mary Whitney and the apple peelings we threw over our shoulders that night to see who we would marry. But I will not tell him that. I think you understand well enough, he says. My sampler, I say. Now it is his turn to know nothing. Your what? He says. My sampler that I stitched as a child, I say. A is for apple, B is for bee. Oh, yes, he says. But what else? I give my stupid look. Apple pie, I say. Ah, he says, something you eat. Well, I should hope you would, sir, I say. That's what an apple pie is for. And is there any kind of apple you should not eat? He says. A rotten one, I suppose, I say. He's playing a guessing game, like Dr. Bannerling at the asylum. There is always a right answer, which is right because it is the one they want, and you can tell by their faces whether you have guessed what it is, although with Dr. Bannerling all of the answers were wrong. Or perhaps he is a doctor of divinity. They are the other ones prone to this kind of questioning. I have had enough of them to last me for a long while. The apple of the tree of knowledge is what he means. Good and evil, any child could guess it. But I will not oblige. I go back to my stupid look.